Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. That little bit of history was great. When they asked if anybody was new, a lot of hands went up, and when they asked if there's anybody who has experience with the 12 steps and is willing to take other people through the 12 steps, a bunch of hands went up. That qualifies this meeting as a pocket of enthusiasm. And if you're new or just coming back, this is a good place to stay loyal to. I was on the phone earlier. There's a guy I've been working with on and off for probably the last 12 years, and he's one of those hard heads that there's a failure to launch into the process sufficiently enough to achieve any long period of sobriety. And, I think we all see this a lot of times. And what it is it's a lack of enthusiasm. This is a pocket of enthusiasm. What kills a lot of alcoholics is a lack of enthusiasm. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that it's a bad idea to put drugs and alcohol in our bodies. You know, duh. We end up in jail, on the streets. An idiot would understand that it's a bad idea to put alcohol and drugs in our body. Yet we have difficulty doing that for any period of time. And then we're exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. We come to it through treatment centers, halfway houses, whatever. And we're exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the first two or three meetings, we're taught what we need to do. We basically were taught during the introduction here, meeting steps and service, the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what you do. That's the secret for long-term sobriety. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand what we need to do. The problem is the motivation and the enthusiasm to engage in that. That's what kills a lot of us. That's what trips a lot of us up. And, I was talking to this guy today, and I was explaining this to him, and I was telling him a little bit about the root or origin of the word enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is one of the definitions of that is the God within you. And I believe sometimes the power greater than ourselves that we need to engage with, I think a lot of times that's where we need to be looking for that elusive enthusiasm. Because without consistent enthusiasm, you won't stay here. And if you're not going to stay here, you're going to be out there, and your chances are much less if you're out there on your own and you're trying to stay clean or you're trying to stay sober. Now, a little bit about me. On or around December 28, 1989, not that I was very clear about the calendar during this period of time, the grace of God separated me from alcohol. It was just one of those horrific benders I had been on. It was in between Christmas and New Year's, and I had started drinking Johnny Walker Black because that was my Christmas drink. Did anybody have special drinks, for the holidays that you would drink? I certainly did. And I started drinking a bunch of this Johnny Walker Black, and it didn't go well. I ended up, I'm home at my mother's house for Christmas. And my brother and sister come traveling in, and there's nieces and nephews, and they're trying to have like a really nice Christmas. The Christmas music is on, and there's presents underneath the tree, and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care. It's just one of those beautiful things, and I'm getting really drunk, and I think somebody said something. You know how they are. What'd you say? And I ended up pulling a .38 caliber handgun on my family and threatening their life. Now, in a complete drunken blackout. Now, this wasn't the festive kind of mood they were all looking for, And they knew me well enough to know I'd feel terrible after shooting them all, but I was quite capable of doing so. So they picked up their Christmas and they moved it elsewhere, thank you. And I come out of this blackout and the house is empty, the presents are gone. I remember standing up and struggling into the kitchen because, you have to rehydrate. You have to put your head under the water spigot for about 10 minutes and try to rehydrate. And you know, I look and there's a pile of vodka bottles like this in the sink that I don't even remember buying. It was just, you know, it started off with the Johnny Walker Black. It ended up with the vodka. And I don't even remember buying these bottles. I must have been drinking, you know, round the clock in a blackout for 3 or 4 days. Now this was just, I made some phone calls to see where people were. I was able to piece together basically what had happened. And then I started to go into the DTs. I started to detox from alcohol. Now, only about 15% of alcoholics ever get to the point where they suffer from delirium tremens or that really violent detoxing from alcohol. But some of us do, and I'm one of those guys. And really the safest place in the world for somebody like that is in a hospital or a detox, because you can usually what will happen is your aorta will pop like a garden hose, and that's your warranty right there. Void it out. You're done. And a lot of alcoholics die in the DTs from, they stroke out or their aorta bursts. And I start going into these DTs and I gotta tell you, it was really bad. There was animals running around the room. There was big animals scraping on the side of the house trying to get in. I later found out it was tree branches, you know, blowing us. But that's not what it was then, you know. There was like animals. And there was maggots all over the place and marching band music, and I was freaking out. I was just freaking out. And for like 2 or 3 days, I was going through this detox. And, you know, there's a surrender process. I think many people misunderstand recovery out there. You know, a lot of people that professionally treat us for it even misunderstand this sometimes. That there's a surrender that is inherent in a good recovery process. And a lot of times that surrender is motivated by experience, bad experience, pain, consequences. A lot of times that's basically what happens. Some of us just get sick and tired of being sick and tired. Some of us we don't want to feel bad anymore. We don't want to be a disappointment to the entire world anymore. And we get to a point where we say, okay, enough is enough. I'm going to go back and listen to those A&As, and I'm going to do whatever the hell they tell me to do. And some of us get motivated to that point. Some of us are stubborn enough to just die. We never get to that point where we're going to surrender. We're just never going to give up, and addiction or alcoholism kills us. What happened with me was that experience over between Christmas and New Year's 1989 motivated me into a prayer. And I didn't have a great relationship with God up to this point in time. If I thought of God at all, I thought of him as like some kind of bizarre cosmic Alan Funt, like somebody that just sets up these crazy circumstances and sits up there in heaven laughing, watching the Schroeder kid, you know, drive into the police station on Quaaludes or some crazy thing like that, because, you know, these are the type of things that happen to me all the time. But some of us, when we're in a foxhole and the bombs are going off, you know, we try to make a deal with God. And I remember, you know, I'm sitting there going through this detox and this demon comes out of the ceiling. It's, you know, I'm hallucinating, obviously, but this demon comes out of the ceiling. I remember screaming like, ah! And I screamed out to God. I go, God, you know, help me. Either kill me or let me get sober. I can't live like this anymore. And it's amazing how many people have similar experiences. Maybe not with the demon coming out of the ceiling, but they have similar experiences. And we get to that jumping off place. We get to that moment of clarity that they talk about sometimes. And, you know, we turn the corner and we stop trying to be the people who are driving our own ship, and we start to look for some help. And we do it with an attitude of humility. And that humility basically is the clouds of delusion part long enough for us to get kind of an accurate self-appraisal on how much trouble we're really in, and start to move forward with looking for help and being serious about following the direction of that help, which is key. I know a million people that when it gets cold outside, they look for treatment processes or VAs or whatever just to get out of the cold. I know a small handful of people who will actually listen and follow direction in those places. And those are usually the people who start to put years together and get long-term sobriety and their quality of life improves. My prayer was, God, either kill me or let me get sober. And, I haven't had a drink since that prayer. It is certainly not that easy, but I'm entirely grateful for that. Now, I've been exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous before. I've been exposed to treatment before. But there was a million things that I misunderstood. Alcoholism and drug addiction are the most misunderstood illnesses in the world. I'm telling you, people that professionally treat you for them misunderstand them. And on the flip side of that, the recovery process is very misunderstood. And it's misunderstood by people who are in the 12-step fellowships for decades. They still misunderstand what the recovery process is. I've learned a lot about what alcoholism is, and 95% of what I've learned comes from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is absolutely amazing that Bill Wilson in the first 100 could have put a book together that significant. You know, over the years, I've been a board member of a lot of organizations. The National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence is one of them. But I'm a board member of a lot of professional organizations that operate at a very high level for professional alcoholism and drug treatment. And I've got to tell you, most people misunderstand the problem. And here's basically the problem if you're an alcoholic. It's a threefold problem. It's you have a mind that is going to convince you, consciously or unconsciously, that you can put alcohol or drugs back in your body. You have a physical continence that once alcohol or drugs are in your body, you are entirely powerless over how long they're in your body or where that drags you. And your life is unmanageable on a lot of levels. It's not necessarily unmanageable that you can't hold a job. It's more emotionally and spiritually unmanageable. There are two things an alcoholic always is when they're brand new. One of them is suffering from anxiety, and the other is suffering from depression. That's untreated alcoholism. That's part of the unmanageability of life. So is guilt, shame, remorse, anger, self-pity, all of that emotional garbage that follows us into these rooms and makes it very, very difficult for us to have effective relationships with people or be consistent with anything positive in our lives. We always blow up our spot somehow. That's really what the unmanageability of alcoholism is. It's a lack of dealage. And if you are an alcoholic and you've got a mind that's gonna help you put alcohol back in your body, that's a real bad thing. And once it's in your body, you have no control over how long or where it's going to take you, and your life totally sucks. That's what alcoholism is. And that's not a good prognosis. Now, what you'll hear from people who misunderstand alcoholism is stuff like this. Kid, just don't take a drink no matter what, even if your ass falls off. Well, if you read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about powerlessness. If we're powerless over alcohol, how can we decide not to put it back in our body and have that mean anything? Here's a clue for you. If every time you decide not to drink and you can hang on to that and make that work consistently, you're not an alcoholic, because what an alcoholic is someone that can't do that. So don't let somebody tell you, to just don't drink. All you need to do, 100%, is just don't drink. There's a lot more involved with not drinking than not drinking. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. Alcoholics Anonymous is about finding a way to stay stopped and have your life have some kind of quality while you're staying stopped. Because I don't know about anybody else, there were brief periods of sobriety when I got a DUI or when I did some crazy thing and horrible shame. You know, I would stay sober for a number of days, but sobriety is untenable to the alcoholic. We don't like it. I'll give you a for instance. This is any day in the last 4 years of my drinking. This is what it would look like. I would come to in the morning, you know, wearing the clothes I had passed out in the night before. My hair would be sticking straight up. I'd be like shattered. You know, I'd stagger into the bathroom and do my vomiting calisthenics, you know. And, you know, I'd throw some water on my face and I'd go out to my $10 car and drive to work, you know, like this because I work. You know, I was an electrician. And I would be swearing to God, this is the last time. I hate feeling like this. Tonight I'm not drinking. I am going to not drink anymore because I feel so ill. It's unbelievable. My head is ringing. I mean, you know, we don't have hangovers. We have something much more toxic than that. We have alcohol poisoning is what we have. That's really what it is. So we're like poisoned. And we're going to work, you know, like a normal person would be in the emergency room feeling half that bad, you know, but we're like used to it because we're, you know, we're just, so what's every day is like. So halfway through, I'm swearing to God, I'm never going to drink again ever. And halfway through the day, I get maybe half a sandwich down. I'm rehydrated. I start to feel, you know, this much human. And quitting time is coming. It's almost 4:30, and I'm starting to think, you know, that decision to quit, like for good and for all, this that I made this morning, that's a pretty strong, that's pretty outrageous of a, you know, that decision may have to be modified. And what I think I'll do is I'll modify it on the way home. I'll stop at the liquor store. And look, that is insanity. The insanity that they talk about in step two is not that you do crazy things when you're drunk. Non-alcoholics do crazy things when they're drunk. That's why it's so dangerous to be on the road New Year's, because of all the amateurs. You know, that's not the thing. You know, what happens in the insanity of alcoholism is we understand at certain times it would be a good idea to stay separated from alcohol, but we can't hang on to that. The insanity returns and we change our mind. We think we're changing our mind about this alcohol thing. No, that's not a changing of your mind. If you changed your mind and put a gun to your head and shot yourself in the head because you thought that would be a good idea, you wouldn't call that a sane act. Well, the same thing is true when we, as alcoholics, go to the liquor store, go to the bar, and use alcohol. It's insane, and that's what they're talking about in the second step. And the thing is it confuses us. Because, you know, sometimes we don't know why we're drinking. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about suddenly. It talks about slamming your fist on the bar, asking yourself, how could I have gotten drunk again knowing what I know? That's that insanity of alcohol. The inability to have an adequate defense against the next drink. And this is what takes us out. This is what separates us as a distinct entity from problem drinkers. I think we all know problem drinkers, right? Those are people who crash cars or get DUIs or do stupid stuff at the parties, you know, but, you know, they can stop if they want to. The alcoholic can't. So here I am, I'm making an attempt in Alcoholics Anonymous because of a bunch of DUIs. And this is what I think. This is my misunderstanding. I think that Alcoholics Anonymous is a group of people that will encourage me not to drink. And if I'm encouraged not to drink by this great fellowship, I won't drink. You know, we're all going to get together. Alcoholics Anonymous is like a big football huddle. You know, we go to the meeting and we circle up and we keep it simple and we first things first and we'll, all meet at the Looney Nooney tomorrow and break, you know? And that's what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was. Until I relapsed, you know, and that relapse ended up with the handgun. Now, I made a decision to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know why. I really think it was divine grace. My decision was I'm going to go back and I'm going to go to a meeting every night. I'm going to do everything I possibly can in AA. I'm going to give this, 100%, and whatever that looks like. And I actually did that. And what I learned that the fellowship is where everything starts. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is where everything starts. It's where we get together. It's where we meet. And we do encourage each other to not drink. And we do encourage each other to go through the steps. And that's a vital and necessary part of our recovery. But meetings don't treat alcoholism. Meetings can bring about a tentative sobriety, but they don't treat alcoholism. What treats alcoholism is the 12 steps, the actual taking of the 12 steps. Now, this was a hard lesson for me to learn because I'm in northern New Jersey. It's like 1989, 1990. There are not a lot of big book meetings and there are not a lot of sponsors who ask you to come over to their house and sit down with the big book and take you through the steps. That's not what was going on in my area back then. What was basically going on was there was a lot of 12 and 12 meetings. There was a lot of open discussion meetings and closed discussion meetings and speaker meetings. And it was more about the fellowship. Now, that's okay. All that fellowship stuff is okay unless you're in real trouble with alcoholism. And I was in real trouble with alcoholism. And I was absolutely nuts. Picture this. I'm going to 13, 14 meetings a week. I'm the cookie guy at this meeting. I'm the coffee guy at this meeting. I'm the secretary over here. I'm driving the boobies from the hatch to the meeting. I mean, I am doing everything. People are patting me on the head. Chris, man, I see you at all the meetings. You're doing great. Pat, pat, pat. But what was going on was inside, I was completely out of my mind. I would be sitting in a meeting. And I'd be sitting there, with this fake smile on my face, and I'd be judging like crazy. I was so critical. My attitude was so negative. I'd be sitting here, and I'd be going, oh, God, I can't believe it. Oh, jeez, did you hear that? Oh, no, he's raising his hand. Oh, my God, he's raising his hand. Oh, please don't call on him. Please. Oh, my God, now they called on him. Oh, no. Now I'm going to have to hear about his family for 10 minutes. Buddy, tell somebody who cares, will you? God, why don't you just drink, so you can get the hell out of here and stop bothering. I can't stand it one more time. What a moron. Now, but that's what's going through my head, but I'm sitting here like this. Thanks for sharing. I'm completely out of my mind. And I'm acting, because they would tell you act as if, I'm acting as if, I've got a hold on reality. And what it was full-blown, untreated alcoholism in a sober state, which is just awful, okay? It's awful. It's tenuous, and you just try to hang on to it. And what happens is, after a while, we just can't take it anymore. We can't take being sober anymore. And what happened to me was in about 8 months, I remember, I found God's will for me. Anybody in here ever get into early relationships and recall them? Beautiful, isn't it? That's like, nothing will put the fear of God in a sponsor quicker than a phone call where somebody goes, I just met somebody. You're like, oh no, there's going to be an uninterrupted series of phone calls for the next 6 months, dealing with this. We're like, oh God. You know, so, but anyway, you know, I got a relationship. I had a problem with my job. My car broke down. Like five or six things happened. And I just, I was at a point where I was not going to be able to make it. I could not take the way I felt one more minute. And what had happened was a couple of weeks before then, this friend of mine, Radio Shack Mike, had given me, everybody had nicknames back in the day, you know, Bummed Out Bob. You know, there was just a whole bunch of, everybody had nicknames. I was the one nicknaming them too, but anyway, Radio Shack Mike gave me a set of tapes, and this is back in the days of cassette tapes. And it was 8 90-minute cassette tapes. And he goes, you know, I didn't like this much. You're hardcore, though. You might like this. I go, well, what is it? And he goes, it's a Joe and Charlie talk, you know. They're a couple of guys from Arkansas. I'm like, Arkansas? What the? Are you kidding me? A couple of guys from Arkansas? What the hell? What, 8 90-minute tapes? How the hell am I going to get through that?
They probably talk like this.
And, you know, Arkansas. So, but he makes me promise to listen to him. So, I'll listen to him. And, you know, I put him in. I got a half an hour ride back and forth to work. So I put him in and I start listening to him. And this, all of a sudden, I started hearing people talking about Alcoholics Anonymous like I had never heard it talked about before. What these guys did, the history of Joe and Charlie, is they're basically people who sat down and took the book Alcoholics Anonymous very, very seriously. And they started, they would go to a lot of conventions and they would get a room and they'd just have like a little big, they'd do a little big book seminar. One day somebody taped one of these seminars and then gave those tapes away as prizes at another convention. And they spread all over the country, and all of a sudden, Joe and Charlie are being asked to go everywhere. And here's basically, in a nutshell, here's basically the message that I got from listening to those tapes. Chris, you're fellowshipping. You are the pope of the fellowship. You are the meeting making mofo. But you have no program. Because if you're not working the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have an AA program. And if you're alcoholic, you're only going to last a certain amount of time without going absolutely crazy and getting locked up, putting a bullet through your head, or drinking. Those are the three things that happen to alcoholics who don't treat their alcoholism with the spiritual process of the steps. That was the message that I got from these tapes. And it kind of upset me because, you know, first of all, if all that was true, why didn't my sponsor tell me this stuff? Why weren't they talking about it in the groups that I was going to? If Joe and Charlie on these tapes are right, then everybody I know in AA is wrong. That can't be possible. Well, I found out it absolutely was possible. It was absolutely possible. Because I was what is called in the book Alcoholics Anonymous a real alcoholic. I need a spiritual recovery process or I shatter into a million pieces. That's what happens to me. And I can't take reality. There's something genetic about this. I truly believe that we get a genetic bullet if we're an alcoholic. We're predestined sometimes to be alcoholics. And I've got a brother who, never had a touch of liquor in his life. He never put liquor to his lips, never smoked, never did any drugs. He was an egghead kind of a kid, grew up in the early 60s, went to Caltech and became a PhD economist. And that's just the path he went. He went the intellectual path. Never put alcohol in his body. But I recognize in him alcoholism at a huge level. He's just never activated it with the alcohol. But he has an inability. He has an inability to hold on to good relationships in his life. He went from one job to another, never getting tenure. You know, he can't he can't develop relationships with people. He's prey to misery and depression. Half the day he's got the covers over his head because he just doesn't want to face life. And he made just enough money so that he can live like in a tiny little apartment where people will leave him alone. And he can live on like $15,000 a year, you know. And he's got that coming. He's got that saved up. So now he's like mothballed. Now that's alcoholism that hasn't been activated with alcohol. But I recognize the spiritual malady in him. You know, we have, it's genetic. We have a spiritual malady, and what happens is we see alcohol or drugs as an answer. Normal people see them as you know, something fun to do, more as an event. We see it as an answer. It's an answer to what's going wrong inside of us. I'll tell you another piece of my own experience that'll kind of show you how this is true in my life. It's 1960. I'm 5 years old. My mother says, get dressed, get in the car. It's your first day at school. I'm taking you to kindergarten. All right? I do what she tells me to do. I get in the car. She drives me across town. She opens up the door and she says, there's the kindergarten classroom. I'll be back later to pick you up. See you later. Get out of the car. I remember getting out of the car and standing up on the hill, looking down at all these kids are playing kickball and tag. They're already integrated. They're already cool with this whole thing. You know, I'm thinking, oh my God, who came up with this kindergarten thing? This is horrible. What if they don't like me? What if I do something stupid? What if I have to get in a fight? I mean, I'm thinking all this stuff is going on in my head, you know, and they're all fine. You know, what the hell is wrong with me? I knew I had to walk down that hill and do this kindergarten thing. I knew I had to, but it was a traumatic experience for me. It's not a traumatic experience for non-alcoholics. Yeah, it's a traumatic. I'll tell you what would have made that whole experience work: a pint of vodka. You know what I mean? I'd have been the kindergarten kid with a pint of vodka, And for the next 7 or 8 years, I had to deal with school with no booze. It was horrible. I mean, you know, they'd call me up to present, you know, a report in front of the class. I'd be like, ah! The worst though, is anybody in here remember square dancing? Oh, God! I remember, they would line up, we'd be in the gym, and they would line up the boys on one side of the gym, and they'd line up girls up on the other side of the gym, and they'd blow the whistle, and you'd have to run across the gym and ask a girl to dance, and she would be your square dancing partner. Now, they have no idea what they're doing to the pre-alcoholic, you know, who's got no booze. I mean, you know, the therapists are still making money, you know, off of this stuff that happened in the 60s with that. But I'm telling you, you know, I'm just terrified of rejection and looking stupid. And, you know, every once in a while I tell the story and a woman will come up afterwards and say, how do you think we felt? You know, oh, you guys running at us, you know. But anyway, listen, later on in high school when I started drinking, I would, you know, if I was sober at the dance, I'd still be like that. I'd be like the wallflower hiding. You get a pint or two of whiskey in me, and I'm a dancing fool. I'll go up and I'll say, hey, babe, you want to dance? And she says no, and it'll be like, oh, you're tough luck, you know, don't be come asking me later, you know. I mean, it's like a whole change in perception, you know. Sober, I'd be like mortified, have to go kill myself because she said no, you know. I mean, that's what alcohol did for me. And all of a sudden, they're telling me, don't drink. Are you crazy? It's the only thing that helps me with the world. This world is crazy. So, but the problem is alcohol is the treatment for alcoholism. It is. It's just a bad treatment. It'll catch up with you. It's progressively fatal, poisoning yourself with alcohol. But alcohol is the treatment for alcoholism. the brilliant thing, the brilliant thing that Wilson and the boys figured out in the early days of AA is you don't fight alcoholism with sobriety. You fight it with spirituality. And if you look at any of the history, if you look at the book Alcoholics Anonymous, if you look at the 12 and 12, you will see that the recovery process is a spiritual recovery process. It's identifying the problem, understanding how serious the problem is, making a decision to engage in the recovery process in the solution, starting to identify the things that are blocking us off from the solution, and ultimately, when we get to the 12th step, we've experienced the solution, and the next thing is to take that solution and offer that to other people and work with other people. That's really what the 12-step process is. Now, early on in AA, this was basically my experience. After being exposed to the Joe and Charlie tapes, there was denial that what they were saying was true. And then I experienced some more pain, like I told you about. And I got to the point where my sobriety was absolutely untenable, and I was either going to drink, kill myself, or go crazy, which is what happens to us. And because I had listened to those tapes, those Joe and Charlie tapes, where they talked about working a program, I made the decision that I'm going to try this. I'm actually going to try Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to try the 12-step process. And I did. I did a very, very imperfect run through the steps. I was listening to the tapes. I had the big book open over here, and I had a notebook. And whenever it would tell me to do something, I would do that and, you know, stop the tape, do that. And I went through it in a very, very imperfect way, but and not out of any sense of virtue, not out of, I want to be a good AA. I was motivated to do this because I didn't want to feel bad anymore. I mean, emotionally, I was just tortured with my emotions, and I just didn't want to feel bad anymore. And Joe and Charlie were saying that this was a solution for that. So okay, I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to give it a shot. And what happened was, this is like 1991. What happened was, I went through the steps. And I started to recover. What happened was my spirit started to heal. We have a spiritual problem. We have a scared little kindergartner problem. And we need a spiritual solution to fix it. And what happened was me engaging in the 12-step process, I started to recover from alcoholism, and my spirit started to heal, and my spirit started to awaken. And I started to get a bunch of people who were asking me to sponsor them, and most of these guys were the type who would drink on you. You know, you ever have a sponsor drink on you, make you look bad? You know what I mean? You know, you lose status because people come up to you and say, "You know, your guy is drinking." You know, God. So, one of the things that I did was I started to bring these guys over to my house, and I started to work the 12 steps with them. I mean, we would do an inventory. We would do all of the things that the 12 steps asked us to do. And, you know, the amazing thing is every single one of those guys in the 90s that went through the steps with me and finished, they're all still in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's remarkable because people just don't stay around AA. You know, if you do a celebration meeting here, you'll see 20 people celebrate 90 days and one person celebrate 15 years. Well, if everybody stayed here, there'd be 20 people celebrating 15 years and 20 people celebrating 16 years and 20 people celebrating 17 years. But you know that doesn't happen. They go away. Well, the amazing thing is the guys that have gone through the steps with me, they're all still around. Every one of them is a card-carrying AA member in good standing, still loyal to a home group, still sponsoring people, and still sober. And their quality of life improves every single year. Every single year, their quality, and they get more and more grateful, for being exposed to the process. That's a significant observation because we have a very, very, we have a killer bad reputation for success. One of the things that I told you that I do is I'm involved with some professional treatment processes, and there's this thing called LinkedIn. Probably most of you know what it is, and there's some addiction groups on there, and treatment groups on there that I'm a member of. And every once in a while, I shouldn't do this, but every once in a while I get engaged in the controversy. You know, there'll be people posting stuff, and I'll stick my two cents in. And I'm sticking my two cents in on this guy. This guy is a professional addiction treatment specialist, okay? He's not quite a psychiatrist, but he's darn close. And he's got a shingle on his wall, and you pay $150 an hour, and he helps you with your addiction or your alcoholism or whatever. And he knows his stuff. He's willing to tell you he knows his stuff. And in this exchange of information, where I'm kind of I'm loyal to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm always going to be. You know, I'm sticking up for it a little bit because he's bashing it. A lot of professionals bash AA these days. And here's what he said. He goes, "I don't recommend that people go to AA or NA or any of the 12-step groups anymore. Those groups have like a 6% recovery rate. I could do better offering placebos." This is what the guy says, okay? He goes, "I could get 10% recovery with placebos. Why would I send somebody to AA?" Now, I get furious. I'm furious. Like, what an idiot this guy is. He's robbing people. He's taking $150 an hour. He's an idiot. But I had to start thinking about what this guy is saying. He's right that there's a 6% rate here for recidivism. But here's how they take the statistics. I know how they do these surveys. They go to the door, usually in New York City or Philadelphia proper or Los Angeles. And what they do is they go up to any meeting in the book, and they stand by the door, and they ask questions. How long have you been coming around? You relapse. And this is how they get their statistics, by people who walk through the door. So I'm thinking, you know, that's not really a fair way to assess Alcoholics Anonymous, because what's true for me is rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That's true for me. I believe that. I've experienced that, and that's observable to me. So I've got to respond back to this guy because he's an idiot. So basically this is, because he's like a doctor, you know, this is basically what I say to him. I go, "Look, let's say you come up with a recovery process for pancreatic cancer and you know that it works. You absolutely know that it works, and you set up a hospital where you do that recovery process and all these people with pancreatic cancer come. And 95% of them sit in the waiting room and talk with other pancreatic cancer patients. And they share about their day with other pancreatic cancer sufferers. And they're grateful for having pancreatic cancer. And they never move out of the waiting room to go into the operating room and undergo your treatment." I go, "Would it be fair to say you have a 5% recovery rate?" And he goes, "Absolutely not, because only 5% of the people are trying my recovery rate." I go, "That's what's going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. 95% of the people sit in the waiting room, which is the meetings. They sit in the waiting room sharing about how grateful they are to be in Alcoholics grateful. And the recovery process is the 12 steps. That's why we have a 6% recovery rate, because 94% of us don't do the steps. Because rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed the path. It is still true to this day. I know it is, because I've personally experienced it." Now, one of the things that I was able to do after taking a number of people through the steps is we decided to start a meeting. I love these types of meetings, these solution-based meetings. Listen, there's enough closed-minded discussion meetings out there. We really don't need that many more. There's enough 12 and 12 meetings where people share about the steps and philosophize about the steps and read the steps and think about the steps and don't do them. You know, there's enough of those 12 and 12 meetings around. I love the meetings where there's an intent there's actually an intent at work for people to be taking other people through the steps. And, you know, I smell that here. And I really support these types of groups. Now, I was able to, in 1997, start a home group, and it was called the Burnsville Spiritual Awakenings Group. And what it was very revolutionary at that time, and I got a lot of crap for it. But what it was basically a workshop meeting where someone with experience with the 12 steps would go through the book Alcoholics Anonymous and share about their experience in going through and elucidate a little bit about the instructions and talk about, you know, talk about the processes and get involved in that way. One of the things that Bill Wolfson wrote was, the sole purpose of an AA group is the teaching and practice of the 12 steps. That's a Bill Wolfson statement. Now, you wouldn't know that going to a lot of different meetings, but that's the sole purpose of a meeting. So when you find meetings like this, they're very powerful because they're impactful, and your chances of recovery attending a meeting like this is greater than attending a meeting where they're not teaching or practicing the 12 steps. Anyway, I got a chance to start the Spiritual Awakenings group, and that's awesome. It's still going on. It's celebrated, I think, 15 years just recently. I'm involved with a meeting in Westfield, New Jersey, which is another Spiritual Awakenings group, which is another workshop meeting where people with experience talk about how they've gone through the steps, I'm all about that. I've got a whole group of sponsees that there's a promise in the book that frequent contact with newcomers is going to be the high spot of your life. The most satisfactory years of your existence are ahead of you. These are promises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that I've experienced. A lot of it has to do with the people that I've met in AA. My life today is extraordinary. It's working on all burners. It's working in my intimate relationships. I'm married to an absolutely wonderful woman. I've known her since she was 15 years old. We were friends in high school, and we've got reacquainted through Facebook. Gotta watch Facebook. Anyway, you know, I'm like, oh my God, Andrea, I haven't talked to her in 30 years, you know, and alcoholically we're living together in a month and a half. Absolutely. It's working too. So that's right. My job life, listen, I had a terrible job when I first got sober. I was a bad electrician working for a bad electrical contractor, blowing stuff up on a daily basis. Just as ill as you could be, you know, just like, oh boss, I lost the van again. You know, like Ignatowski, you know, from Taxi. It was just a horrible, horrible experience. You know, today I'm a facility manager. I'm running a giant $10 million piece of business. A pharmaceutical manufacturing plant where we manufacture life-saving medications. We actually manufacture, in the plant that I'm in charge of, we manufacture a drug that cures malaria. And the World Health Organization buys all of it and sends it, you know, who the hell knows where, and it's out there saving millions of lives. So what I'm doing on a daily basis is helping to save millions of lives. It's incredible. I had a terrible job. I've got a great job now. You know, my relationships with my family are really good. My relationships with my friends are really good. Everything is working right. And I gotta tell you, I take absolutely no personal credit for that. It's not because I'm smarter or more well adapted. It's quite the opposite. I am pre-programmed to shoot myself in the foot every chance I get. What it is it's the constant application of the spiritual principles and practices that we find in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've just been pretty consistent with trying my best to apply those principles. And what's happened is I'm overpaid in every way in my life today. I can't tell you how grateful I am to be on this planet, right, having this experience right now. And in this meeting, you know, having the opportunity to share some of my story. And with that, I'm done. So thank you for being here tonight.